From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Sin Eater, The Crimes of Anthony Pelicano, examines the rise and fall of the infamous private investigator. Pelicano went to prison for more than 15 years for wiretapping and other crimes, but almost all of his powerful clients walked away unscathed.
Our audience is going to have to listen to some of these recordings with people like Chris Rock or Marty Singer, or, you know, whoever, and come to their own conclusions based on what he himself is saying about whether they think people should have been held more responsible than they ultimately were.
In their documentary, filmmakers and New York Times journalists Rachel Abrams and Liz Day include Pelicano's description of his misdeeds alongside victims' accounts of the devastating impact of his campaigns of intimidation. And I throw in some memories of my own interactions with Pelicano and his clients over the years. But first, we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So starting on Monday, the Writers Guild will be negotiating with the studios. There has been a long drumbeat leading up to this because most people, I think, in the town believe that there will be a strike. We had one in 2008. It was long and created a lot of ill feeling. And of course, people suffer. But it feels like there just is a moment where certainly the Writers Guild and very possibly some of the other guilds are feeling that they are up against the wall and they need to protect themselves and get guarantees about compensation above all. And at the same time, the studios are belt tightening, and there are those who feel that the studios, some of them at least, would welcome a writer's strike as a chance to do the kind of house cleaning and getting rid of expensive deals and, you know, making things cheaper for a while, that they might be willing to have a strike and not necessarily rush to end it. That's going to be a very fraught situation for Hollywood for the unforeseeable future.
Yeah, it's definitely pins and needles time. And there is such a chasm between the two sides right now. If you talk to the writers, I mean, they have really been left behind in this streaming revolution. The entire economics of the business have changed, yet the calculations and the negotiated schemes for how they're paid have not caught up to this. It's everything from the minimums that they get. You know, there are different rates for streaming that there are for the broadcast and cable models. There are these mini rooms that have popped up where they are writers' rooms, but in miniature, which can break the stories for shorter episode seasons and eliminate the need for more writers. The fact is, many writers are not working as much because they have these shorter seasons. And if you get one job, it's not a year's worth of work anymore. It's a couple months. And all of these types of things, the residual scheme especially, is just so out of whack with streaming versus the traditional methods that the studios just don't want to deal with this. They don't want to deal with these writers saying, oh, change the entire system. Don't just give us a percentage bump. The studios would just rather say, here's a percentage bump, just like we've done always, and go your merry way. That's not going to cut it this time, I don't think.
Yeah, and I felt like David Zaslav's moves in the last year or so, you know, ripping stuff off the streamer, canceling movies that were almost finished, it just almost demands that kind of thing for the writers to stand up and maybe the directors and SAG-AFTRA as well.
Yeah, that's the question here, because a writer strike is one thing. An entire industry strike is a complete separate thing and much more damaging. And the other guilds, they don't have to necessarily strike in solidarity with the writers. They can continue negotiating, they can cut their own deals, or they can say, we're not going to work if our writer colleagues are not working either. Remains to be seen what they might do, but these other guilds are not happy either. The directors are typically a much more passive group, and they often will negotiate first. They have decided to let the writers go first here, and that's a big sign that they are also unhappy with the system that they have.
Yes, absolutely. Let me pivot away to Netflix. As you know, this past week, we are told that Netflix passed on a Nancy Meyers movie. Netflix offered $130 million to make this movie. It's a movie about an alienated Hollywood couple that's forced to work together on a movie set, which might echo back to Nancy Meyers' dissolved marriage to Charles Shire, that we worked together for years. The talent in this thing was like Scarlett Johansson, Owen Wilson, Penelope Cruz, Michael Fassbender, and Nancy Meyers herself. But she wanted more than $130 million. She wanted $150 million. And for once, Netflix said no.
Yeah, I mean, the amusing part here is obviously, you know, Nancy Meyers famous for her budgets and famous for her interior decor in her movies, so you can make your own kitchen joke. But beyond that, it really is a sign of the times, I think. Just like the Black Widow standoff over Scarlett Johansson's pay on that movie in the COVID times where movies were going day and date on streaming, that was emblematic of what was going on then. This is emblematic of the great Netflix correction, as I call it, where the stock market's down, everyone's looking at their budgets, and a previous regime at Netflix probably would have looked at this and said, oh, we want to be in the Nancy Meyers business. We are an upstart and want to have a big star-driven film from her. We'll give her the $150 million if she really wants it. Now, they're looking at this and say, okay, 130 is plenty. That is reportedly $80 million for above-the-line costs. Stars, talent, $80 million. That is a lot of money. They're holding the line. If she takes this elsewhere, she takes it elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, this is not necessarily the kind of thing that plays internationally, like a big action movie or thriller. I think a lot of people would think $130 million was plenty. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News.
A wiretap is recording both sides of a telephone conversation, and a bug is usually involved in a rumor or an enclosure. Because smart guys didn't really use the phone to communicate certain things. They would talk, you know, in their home in a certain room.
That's private investigator Anthony Pelicano in a 2021 episode of Alec Baldwin's podcast, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin. In his heyday, Pelicano's clients included studio executives, a few of Hollywood's most powerful lawyers, and some big names in entertainment, Michael Jackson, Chris Rock, Michael Ovitz, among others. Pelicano was tasked with digging up dirt, covering up scandals, and intimidating those who posed problems to his clientele. For a modest retainer of $25,000, the self-proclaimed Prince of Darkness did many dark deeds, only some of which have come to light. In their two-part documentary, Sin Eater, The Crimes of Anthony Pelicano, New York Times journalists Rachel Abrams and Liz Day investigate the rise and fall of the notorious fixer, who was the go-to guy in Hollywood until 2008, when the authorities stepped in.
Pelicano and several others have been indicted on 112 counts for racketeering, illegal wiretapping, and illegally obtaining confidential information.
Yesterday, Pelicano was sentenced to 15 years in prison for running a wiretapping operation.
I'm Sicilian, you understand? And I'm a man of honor. I take all the heat. I'm a sin eater, that's what I do.
So what was it that made you guys decide to look into Anthony Pelicano or do a piece about him now?
Variety had run a story back in 2021 for him, kind of as a fixer. And I think a few people at the Times saw that and came up with the idea at the same time that he would make for a great documentary. And in particular, Pelicano represents, you know, the early 2000s. There are a lot of pieces of that story that felt really relevant to today. That the story is fundamentally a very human story about powerful people who find ways to bend the rules to their advantage and get around the systems that the rest of us have to abide by. And so while his techniques might be a bit analog, he involved a lot of the same problems that we're all discussing. You know, we are still talking about police officers leaking confidential information to benefit powerful people in Los Angeles. Of course, Kim, you know that I'm thinking about Les Moonves and the LAPD. We're still talking about invasion of privacy issues with reporters. There's a Wall Street Journal reporter that's accused a prominent law firm of hiring hackers who broke into his email and basically got him fired. So it felt very much relevant to a lot of stuff that is in the news and is very topical today. And then lastly, I would say, we were also curious about how some of the victim stories were told at the time and whether they were taken seriously or whether Pelicano kind of became the show. And so whether some of these victim stories were worth revisiting and whether any of them had been prematurely dismissed or not taken seriously enough.
Yes. I don't know that it was so clear who the victims were. I mean, when it really became a public thing, as I well remember, was when one of Pelicano's, I guess I'm going to say henchmen, was dispatched to intimidate Anita Bush, who was working on a story about Steven Seagal for the LA Times. And certainly that, I don't remember, like, was that public at the time? Just remind me about that.
Well, just going back to your victim question for a second, I think the victims were people who felt that they had their privacy invaded. And some of these people there ended up being evidence that their privacy was invaded. For instance, their phones were tapped, but other people only had suspicions. And a lot of the damage here is the psychological damage of knowing that perhaps there was evidence that your phone was tapped. Is somebody following you? Is somebody listening to you now? Is somebody sitting outside of your house and spying on you, looking where you're going? I think a lot of the victims that spoke with us and their attorneys would say that some of these people never got over sort of the feeling of always having to look over your shoulder. So with Anita Bush, I mean, she is probably the most well-known and devastating example because, as you mentioned, Alex Proctor was hired by Pelicano to intimidate, you know, Pelicano would say he just hired him to stake out Anita's house. But we know that there was basically a death threat left on her car. And the psychological damage that that might do to a person, I mean, you could only, how would you feel if, you know, that had happened to you, and throw in all the other invasions of privacy? I think that when we're talking about the victims, that's kind of what we're keeping in mind.
If you want me to be myself and threaten them, then I'll do that.
No, I don't want you to threaten them.
Well, then how do you do it unless you threaten somebody? That's the way everybody fucking moves for me when I threaten their fucking lives.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually many times asked myself how I would react if somebody left a dead fish in a, she apparently shot a bullet through her windshield and a note saying stop was left. I don't know, because it never happened. I do, however, suspect that I was wiretapped by Pelicano at one point. I asked him and he denied it, but I'm not taking that to the bank. And I will note that this was during, I think we were working on the book Hit and Run about Sony's acquisition of Columbia Pictures and the hiring of John Peters and Peter Guber, which turned into a big fiasco for Sony. And my phone started to make a lot of noise. And people would say to me, what is that noise? And I would say, I don't know. But if somebody wants to wiretap my phone and hear what people really think of these people, what really telling us about them, you know, have fun, because we're getting a lot of good stuff on John Peters and Peter Guber. And, you know, I don't know how happy you're going to be hearing somebody give a real off the record opinion that they would not necessarily say in public, but we could use in the book. At one point, my editor at Vanity Fair said to me, I'm really tired of this noise, and I want you to have the phone swept, and we'll pay for it. Just get it done. And not unlike in your show, where Diane Diamond sort of set up, she was cleverer than I was. She really set a trap to show that he was tapping her phone. But when my editor did say that, the noise stopped immediately, and I never actually bothered, because I figured if there had been a wire on the phone, it would be gone. Tell people how Diane Diamond set that trap for him.
So Diane Diamond, for people who aren't familiar with her, was an investigative reporter. She was working for Hard Copy back in the 90s. And she really was at the vanguard of the Michael Jackson child sexual abuse allegation story. And while she was reporting that story, she started to suspect that her phones were tapped. As you described, she often started hearing clicks and pops. And, you know, unusual things were happening where it felt like other people knew the contents of her phone conversations. So she devised a little plot in which she had her husband call her, but pretend to be, I think, a source for a documentary. And so her husband called her and said, you know, oh, I have some questions about the documentary that you're working on about Pelicano. And then, you know, she said, oh, it's going great. I'm so excited for the documentary, but I gotta go. And after she hung up the phone, she said a few minutes later, she got a call from a lawyer at the production company that made Hard Copy. And they said, are you working on a documentary about Anthony Pelicano? And she said, what are you talking about? And they said, we just got a call from Howard Weitzman's office saying you're working on one. And she said, you know, I knew it. That was proof that I was being tapped. How else would anyone, you know, ever think that we were making a documentary about Anthony Pelicano?
I can't quite remember when I met Pelicano, but he was very much the thing of the moment. I remember the producer, Don Simpson, who was definitely a Pelicano guy, told me once when I annoyed him some way. I don't remember what I did that annoyed him, but he was annoyed. He said, I'm going to have Pelicano look into you and you're not going to like it. And I said, well, you know, I'm pretty boring, Don. So, you know, it's not going to be too rewarding. And he said this line that I have never forgotten, which is, it's not what we'll find, but how we'll make it look. So,
wow. Yep. We should have interviewed you for the documentary, Kim.
I will say, when I first started interacting with Pelicano, he, as is shown in your series, he was so theatrical about himself and using such kind of central casting, hard-boiled detective guy and investigator that I didn't take him that seriously. I thought, this is like a joke. And I actually remember talking to Warren Beatty about Pellicano and saying, how do you even think this guy is for real? You know, he's so theatrical. And I remember Warren Beatty said, well, he is rather self-dramatizing. And then, you know, as shown in the show, you know, it comes to light that he is not just this comedic figure. He is really much more dangerous. I only found out once the authorities got involved, much more dangerous, really, than I had imagined.
Yes, definitely. John Connolly, who was a reporter for Vanity Fair, he made an excellent point in one of his articles that basically, like, these people that hired him, because he looked like the detective that would be played on TV, they thought that he knew what he was doing. Because he seemed, as you said, that he was coming straight from central casting, they thought, well, he must know what he's doing. But I think a lot of normal people or people that had any experience with legitimate private investigators or law enforcement looked at him and was like, this guy seems like a buffoon. Like, this is not the way that a legitimate, responsible private investigator would comport themselves. I think that there was a big divide among his potential consumers. There were the people who were entranced by him and felt that his swagger certainly must have meant something. And then there were the people who were immediately turned off and thought, how could anybody buy what this guy is selling?
Coming up after the break, Rachel Abrams and Liz Day talk about the curious bromance between Anthony Pellicano and former NBC Universal Vice Chairman Ron Meyer. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters.
Listen, I've got a bit of a problem, and I need to see if you can help me.
I got a problem. I need some advice on.
I just like to make this guy's life as miserable as possible.
My strong guess is that he's out with either a hooker, call girl, or girlfriend.
I wanted something to discredit her.
I want you to do whatever you can to get whatever information you need to.
Those are a few examples of what typical business calls sounded like for private investigator Anthony Pellicano. From the 1980s through the early 2000s, the notorious fixer served the Hollywood elite until he went to federal prison on 78 charges of wiretapping, racketeering, conspiracy, and wire fraud. In their two-part documentary, Sin Eater, The Crimes of Anthony Pellicano, New York Times journalists Rachel Abrams and Liz Day speak to victims of Pellicano's intimidation and invasions of privacy. And they ask the man himself to share his version of his career. I think my colleague Nancy Griffin, who was a co-author on Hit and Run with me, had some conversation with him where he said something to the effect of, you know, bad things happen to little girls who put their noses where they don't belong. And then there was a journalist, he's not a journalist, he's moved out of the field, but he was working on something to do with Pellicano and the National Enquirer, where Pellicano was constantly connected. And he was sideswiped when he was riding his bike. There's always that thing with Pellicano stuff where, you know, it's implied that something terrible is going to happen. He doesn't hit you when you're on the bike. But I mean, he even talks about it in your piece quite a lot. The fear. He nurtured fear in people to achieve his ends.
I want to make the story you just told even more interesting because Rod Lurie, who unfortunately, he ended up not in the ultimate version of the film, but we did talk to him and he was fascinating. And he was actually hit from behind. I don't know if you remember this, but he was hit from behind while he was on his bike and he ends up in the hospital and he gets home and he immediately gets a call and it's Pellicano who had been trying to intimidate him, according to his telling, over some articles he was doing on the National Enquirer that the Enquirer didn't like and had hired Pellicano to deal with. And Pellicano calls Rod and says, I heard you got into a little dust up, like, hope you're okay. And Rod told us, look, I have no idea who hit me from behind. Witnesses said it looked like a hit and run. And I'm not saying that Pellicano did it, but I am saying that he wanted me to believe that he had done it.
Yeah, it's funny. My memory edited it so that he was scared but not hit. But I guess that the darker story is the one that I dropped out of my mind for some reason. I don't know why. You know, there's a point in the show where he says something like, oh, honey, did I do anything illegal? Of course I did. And it made me think of when Don Simpson, the producer, died. And, you know, Don had a lot of drug issues. I was doing a piece for Vanity Fair and I talked to Pellicano and he told me on the record that he had gone to Don's house and cleaned the place before the cops got there. And it was so striking to me that I kept waiting for him to say, that's off the record. And he was so confident and connected with somebody in the police department, you know, as you have people who got in trouble for helping him, that he didn't go off the record. He just acknowledged that. And I thought, that is incredible. He said, that's a crime. And he's just telling me.
Did you, Kim, after he got arrested, did you see that as a sign of how he had really ingratiated himself with law enforcement? Or did it strike you as really reckless, the kind of reckless behavior that led to him serving such a long prison sentence?
Honestly, what I thought was that he must have done something that took the police department, and I don't want to smear the whole LAPD, but I thought he did something across a line, and I think maybe it was the Anita Bush thing. I don't know what, I can't quite be sure of the timing, but that he did something where he was no longer tolerated. I mean, the same thing happened in a way with Heidi Fleiss, the madam. You know, she was not being hassled until she was. And I thought maybe when you get a little out of hand, the police say, that's it, that's enough.
That's a really interesting theory.
That is really interesting. And one additional thing that makes me think of is, I believe Anthony had told us, you know, I used to do so much for the cops. And, you know, to the degree we couldn't fact check how much of that was true, but I think it is likely that, you know, he would do a lot for the police department, you know, pass along tips or help them out in certain ways. And I think that might have created a coziness, which, yeah, led to, it took a while for him to be prosecuted for doing illegal things.
Yeah. The bigger issue is that, you know, he subsequently, it becomes about the wiretapping and all of the parties who benefited, as you point out. And I think that includes Mike Ovitz, that includes Brad Gray, who was, you know, I think at that point he was already head of the Paramount film studio. They all walked away.
Yeah.
I remember going to the trial one day and there was some poor older woman who had taken some money from the phone company. And I thought, wow, this is really unbelievable. This poor person who's probably making a tiny amount of money and barely getting by got pulled in. And these other people are walking away. And I know because I talked to Brad Gray all the time before he was at Paramount and while he was at Paramount. I know that when this stuff really started to heat up, he was absolutely terrified and thought his career was over. And then one day he said to me, it's okay, I'm off the hook. And I had this very candid, you know, frank relationship with him. And I said, well, Brad, we know you're guilty. So how do you know you're off the hook? And he said, let's just say I know. And I've always wondered, ever since that started, what went on there? You know, how is it that they claimed, the cops, that they couldn't de-encrypt some of the tapes from the phone tapping? But couldn't they? Really? The FBI couldn't do that? I never quite believed that.
I mean, that is a really good question. And I think the people involved in the case might tell you, look, if this had been priority number one, national security, like if we had given this over to the NSA, would they have been able to decrypt this? Maybe. But like, this was largely seen as a Hollywood story, which, as we all know, a lot of mainstream news outlets and a lot of parts of society maybe take Hollywood stories less seriously than they should. And so the impression I got from talking to people, I don't know if Liz would agree with this, was that like there was some thinking that like if the entire weight of the justice system had actually been put behind trying to get into these things, like maybe they could have. But this was about like, oh, those celebrity people, you know, like it's not worth massive government resources. I mean, I think there were like two prosecutors on this thing.
Yeah, I think additionally, it wasn't just that, you know, many files were encrypted. Pelicano told us himself that he didn't record many of his most important clients. So by design, he set it up that there wouldn't be evidence. And he also told us he stored the wiretap calls themselves. What you hear in the documentary are his calls with his clients, as opposed to the wiretap calls between, you know, a client and their wife or whatever. He did not store them in his office. So they were never seized by the government.
You have this appearance by Ron Meyer, the former vice chairman at NBC Universal. Some of my colleagues were like, why would he do this? But Ron Meyer, I mean, to me, it was like a hostage video. I have to assume and suspect Ron Meyer is known to have a lot of history of gambling and losing a lot of money. And he had this situation where Charlotte Kirk, the wannabe actress, was demanding money from him. This all became very public and he lost his job. But Pellicato knows things about Ronnie Meyer that he was very careful not to say too much. He looked like he was at the dentist's office trying to get a sentence out with a pained expression.
I think that's a very fair and apt description of Ron Meyer in the documentary, that he looks like he's at the dentist's office. And he is not there because he wants to be there. He is there going on camera because Anthony asked him to. We had asked Pellicano, you know, we want someone to go on camera who knows you well and can speak about you as a person. And he said, oh, Ronnie can do it.
I mean, the guy that I'm closest to in the world is Ron Meyer. He's like my brother. I mean, he took care of me the whole time I was in prison. He was a stand-up, no-bullshit man.
We sat down with him, and I don't think we came away with any better understanding of why the two of them are so close.
Why?
You know, yes. They have a brotherhood. They were basically crying when they spoke about how much they loved each other. And I will also say, we really asked Ron to reckon his love and brotherhood relationship with Anthony with, you know, the crimes that Pellicano has been accused of doing and victims' testimony of how much damage he caused their life. We said, how do you reckon those two things? And he also really wouldn't go there. His answer was that he doesn't know much about it. He doesn't know whether it's true. He doesn't care whether it's true. You know, he respects Pellicano as a man for not ratting, and they love each other like brothers.
Yeah, and of course, he visited Pellicano in prison. He's the one, and he picked him up from prison when he got out. You know, one of the mysteries you touch on is whether the people who walked away with no damage somehow put money into an account or gave money to the family and made it in some way intolerable and worth his while. I mean, he obviously wouldn't want to. It would be against his self-image of what is honorable to say anything and turn as a witness against the people who used him, but he didn't. And that question lingers, right?
Absolutely. That is a question that, of course, does linger. I think a lot of intelligent people are asking. There must be other charities besides Anthony Pellicano, as one of the FBI agents in our film puts it. And Pellicano kind of talks out of two sides of his mouth. He says, on the one hand, I kept everybody in the dark. I didn't tell Burt Fields or any of these other powerful lawyers what I was up to. But then he also says, I never ratted, which obviously implies that if he wanted to get other people in trouble, he could. And maybe people weren't as innocent as they believed to be. And so I think our audience is going to have to listen to some of these recordings with people like Chris Rock or Marty Singer, you know, whoever, and come to their own conclusions based on what he himself is saying about whether they think people should have been held more responsible than they ultimately were.
So it seems like you had so much more material. I mean, it could have gone more than two episodes, but didn't, you know, you've been talking about things just in this interview that would have been fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, if anybody wants to give us a third episode, hey, listen, we got plenty.
I bet you do. Rachel Abrams is a reporter and senior producer for The New York Times Presents, and Liz Day is a reporter and executive producer for The New York Times Presents. Sin Eater, The Crimes of Anthony Pellicano is now streaming on FX on Hulu. I want to thank you both so much for joining. Such an interesting subject and so many memories.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
Yes, total pleasure.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Desmond Taylor and Matt Schwartz, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.